Monster Man, special episode, Elves. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers. Now, if you are one of those backers and you're watching the spreadsheet in which I list all the upcoming episodes, you'll know that this is slightly out of order. I've moved this one a little bit up the line, and that is basically because I'm waiting for some Patreon backers to get back to me with what they want their specials to be about. Please do not be concerned. New patrons will get their specials made just as soon as they choose their topics. And I had one person ask me for Dealer's Choice, and I'm definitely going to do that one, but short on time this week, I thought that I would do one that I knew pretty much what I was going to say, and I didn't have to make any decisions. So, that is why this episode is about elves, and it is brought to you by Patreon supporter and one of my longest-standing Patreon supporters, Stan Radzeski. Stan, thank you very much for your continued support of Monster Man. It really means a lot to me, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. If you'd like to be like Stan and get your own special episode, in fact, this is Stan's second episode, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. But if you want to pledge at a lower level, that's okay too. At the $1 level, you'll get access to bonus content like our recent episode on the game The Woods. At the $2 level, you'll get that plus access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is all about the Deities and Demigods book. And at the level after that, the $5 level, you'll get the opportunity to pick a topic for a special extra long episode like this one. Okay, so Stan specifically asked that I talk about elves as monsters, not like elves as player characters or just elves as an element of the setting. So it behooves us then to do what I usually do and go back to the folklore, because I think if you go and look at the folkloric elf, you will see a more monstrous creature. But at the same time, I think that there is also room in the sort of Tolkien elf, the elf image that has become dominant in most forms of fantasy literature and art, to be monstrous as well. So elf is a Germanic word. It appears in Scandinavian languages, in German, in English, and it appears to come from, ultimately, a root that means white. Elves appear in the mythology of a number of different cultures. You get them in Old Norse folklore, you get them in sort of Old High German stuff, and perhaps the earliest recorded written sources are in Old English texts, and it's also Anglo-Saxon England that was my area of specialty, so that's probably what I'm mostly going to be talking about. In these folkloric sources, elves appear to be kind of another race of possibly malevolent, possibly invisible, possibly human-like supernatural creatures. Basically, they seem to be what you or I would call fairies. If you look at the Old English evidence, there's a good deal of evidence to support the idea that they were quite important in English belief. For example, they appear a lot in Old English personal names. A lot of Old English names are, I think the word is dithemic, that is to say, they consist of two distinct parts, each of which has a meaning. So for example, if you met an Old English speaker whose name was Wulfstan, that literally means wolf stone. Or in Beowulf, King Hrothgar, his name means glory spear. So it's very common to get elf, which just means elf, as an element of a personal name. And obviously the most famous example of this is Alfred, which means elf council. But you also get people with names like Alfher, that's the guy better known as Saint Alfage, and that means elf high. You also get names like Alfgiffe, elf gift, things like that. So elves, in the sense of whatever it meant to people, seem to have played an important role in Anglo-Saxon culture. And they are glossed in different ways in Christian Anglo-Saxon texts. So for example, in one case, the word elf is glossed as a translation for Satan. But in other cases, they're referred to as angels. And some have suggested that in medieval Scandinavian literature, or Icelandic literature, I should say, when Snorri Sturluson divides elves into the light elves and the dark elves, he's talking about angels and demons. And that is a sense of elves that we will obviously return to when we get to the work of J.R.R. Tolkien. One of the other most important sources for elves in Old English texts comes from magical charms, which are intended to protect people against elf shot. And elf shot was the idea that, like, when you have a sudden stabbing pain, like a stitch or a cramp. That's you've been shot by an elf. It shot you with a dart or an arrow. And I believe, although I don't know what the actual source for this is, but I have been told that prehistoric arrowheads were often understood to be the arrowheads of elves. Like, if you would find one, you know, where did this stone arrowhead come from? Because obviously, that's not the kind of arrow that people use today. And the people would say, well, oh, well, then it must be elves. The idea that it was, you know, thousands upon thousands of years old would not have occurred. This is not a culture that typically imagines technological change as going forward. Some of the charms against elf shot are grounded in explicitly Christian ritual, some in quasi-Christian ritual, and some in rituals that contain no Christian elements at all. Now, I don't want to go out of the way and call these pagan. I don't think that if you looked at the people who were doing them, if you asked them, you know, if you had a time machine or something, you went back and asked them if they were heathen, I don't think they would have said that they were. They would have said that they were Christians, but this is magic rather than religion. And even the not very Christian ones sometimes have a little bit of Christian element to them. So I'm going to read just a quick example of an elf shot charm. This is from a book by Karen Louise Jolly called Popular Religion in Late Saxon England, Elf Charms in Context. I've not had occasion to open it up these many years, so it's nice to kind of return to my roots. I was really looking for a copy of Alaric T.P. Hall's book on elves in Anglo-Saxon England, and I could have sworn I had it, but I guess not. I must have just got it out from the library, so sorry about that. But if you're really into the history of elves in the early Middle Ages, I believe that is the definitive work. So we have really two medical manuscripts from the Anglo-Saxon period. This is from one of them, the Lochnunga. This is called For a Sudden Stitch. Loud were they, low loud, when they rode over the mound. They were fierce when they rode over the land. Shield yourself now, that you may escape this evil. Out, little spear, if herein you be. Stood under linden, under a light shield, where the mighty women readied their power, and they screaming spears sent. I back to them, again will send another, a flying dart against them in return. Out, little spear, if herein it be. Sat a smith, forged he a knife, little iron, strong wound. Out, little spear, if herein it be. Six smiths sat, war spears they made. Out, spear, not in spear. If herein be a bit of iron, hag's work, it shall melt. If you were in the skin shot, or were in flesh shot, or were in the blood shot, or were in bone shot, or were in limb shot, may your life never be torn apart. If it were Azir shot, or it were elves shot, or it were hags shot, now I will help you. This is your remedy for Azir shot. This is your remedy for elves shot. This is your remedy for hags shot. I will help you. It fled there into the mountains. No rest had it. Whole be you now. Lord help you. Then, take the knife, dip into liquid. Okay, so that's the charm. And as you can see, it lists elves among a bunch of other types of supernatural creatures who might shoot you, causing a sudden pain. And there are other examples of elves being treated as kind of devils in this literature. But other times, they appear almost as quite human-like. Just sort of, this is another community of magical creatures who maybe try to steal people away and take them to Elfland. And then, of course, in the post-medieval period, elves undergo a bit of a revival, you know, like in A Midsummer Night's Dream. They become kind of frolicking, fun creatures. And then in the 19th century, they get reimagined as more serious kind of pseudo-medieval creatures. And it's these elves that mostly show up in the work of Tolkien. Because we can't avoid talking about Tolkien when we talk about elves in Dungeons & Dragons. I know that the early D&D players were not supposed to have been big fans of Tolkien. They're clearly influenced by him in their understanding of what an elf might be. So in Tolkien's elves, we see basically two types. There's the type that we mostly think of, and these are the elves as they appear in The Lord of the Rings and in The Silmarillion, right? Dignified, noble, wise, powerful both physically and magically, larger-than-life characters somewhere between humanity and the divine. If we were going to accept Snorri Sturluson's understanding, and again, this is not something that Snorri says, that's something that later scholars have interpreted, this idea that Snorri's sense of light and dark elves is based on angels and devils, then we can really see Tolkien's elves as being sort of angelic. But it isn't necessarily the case that they are morally better, or at least not that they're morally perfect. There's certainly elves have got moral failings, as we see from the history of Middle-earth. But in The Hobbit, we do get rather serious Lord of the Ringsy style elves, but we also get much more whimsical elves who appear to be having fun and having a good time and just kind of living in the forest, frolicking and stuff. And that was the image of elves that appeared in the elf entry with the sort of Robin Hood hats and the what have you. And in The Lord of the Rings, there's definitely the sense of the potential for elves to go villainous, right? This is the temptation of Galadriel, this idea that if she were given access to this power, she would, you know, want to use it for good, but she would, in fact, tyrannize and dominate. And there's a thing about the hazards of excellence, right? The idea that it is better to put this immense power in the hands of a humble person because they may not have the same ambition as these exceptional creatures, but that Galadriel at least is wise enough to realize that fact. So we've got folkloric elves, mysterious invisible creatures shooting you with invisible arrows, Midsummer Night's Dream elves frolicking in the woods playing pranks on unsuspecting mortals, and Tolkien elves, serious, dignified, maybe doomed expressions of this culture with close ties to transcendence. How do we take those and turn them into monsters? I propose that there are three distinct modes of elves as monsters. The first is elves as antagonists, let's call them. And this is where elves are playing the role of bandits or pirates or mercenaries or whatever, right? You're going through the woods, you get shot at with some arrows, you get taken captive. It's just like as if you were taken captive by humans, more or less, right? So the elves are basically playing the role of the unseen enemy. Or they could be playing the kind of, if you'll forgive a Warhammerism, high elf role, where you need to go and talk to somebody and, you know, get some potentate's permission to do something. Only this potentate is an elf rather than a human, and the guards in her throne room with their high-plumed helmets and their brightly colored pennons, though, are elves rather than humans. Now, this might seem like just using elves as humans, and I think the key here is to think about the encounters with elves in The Hobbit. Because the thing that distinguishes the conversations between the main characters and the elves in The Hobbit is that I don't think it's really suggested very much that the elves aren't, in their way, good guys. But they're not at all convinced that the protagonists are good guys. Now, I haven't read The Hobbit in a long time, so maybe I'm oversimplifying or misremembering, but encounters with elves in this mode are essentially encounters with human forces, but without even the baseline sympathy that comes from the other person being the same species as you. These people have no reason to extend you the benefit of the doubt. And if you're a party of Dungeons & Dragons characters, there is a very good chance that you've got a record of, let's say, achievement that's going to reinforce the fears and prejudices of the people that you have to deal with. So here we're basically just taking the situation and saying, well, I don't know, what's one step below a human? Like a half-orc. So two elves, all of these people are in the position that humans probably look at half-orcs, right? They're dirty, dangerous, narrow-minded, dumb brutes. And we captured a bunch of them coming through our forest, and they're all got long swords and maces of disruption and spell books, and they have an awful lot of gems in their wagon, and we have no use for these gems, but clearly these people are robbers. And they might even be right. That lack of empathy gives the elves a sense of ruthlessness. And we should hold on to that idea of ruthlessness because it's going to come back when we look at them later on. This is the ruthlessness that comes from alienness, but it's also the ruthlessness that comes from the long lives of elves, right? That they should look at humans and go, well, I could just kill this person. Yeah, humans only live to about 70, so really it's like, you wouldn't necessarily feel that your decision was hugely significant because it was going to die anyway. Mortals are going to die anyway. Clues in the name. So strangeness and distance is the first level of elvish antagonism, where we're playing them in a more or less tactical way. They're just another faction on the map, they're just another polity, but they don't share any fundamental assumptions with you. They don't recognize you as the same kind of thing as them. And if you want to persuade them of something, you have to do it entirely on the merits of your case. They don't grant you any starting position. After a lack of empathy, we have arrogance. And I want to postulate here that the elves messing around in A Midsummer Night's Dream and the Valley is Jolly, tra-la-la-la-lally elves in The Hobbit are messing around because they don't really take the situation seriously. That is to say, they don't take you and they don't take your problems seriously. This goes hand in hand with the arrogance of the immortal toward a mortal, right? Like, ultimately, whatever it is that you're making such a fuss about, they just don't really think it's all that big of a deal. And they are very unlikely to listen to your argument as to why it is a big deal, because they know better than you. Now, when you encounter ordinary elves, this is just going to manifest in the form of a kind of dislikable snobbery. And this is the point where I reach my usual position about how I hate elves. I hate elves. I hate the idea of like a natural aristocracy of intellectual aesthetes who, you know, sneer at the concerns of the average Joe, right? Give me a dwarf any day, a gruff, hardy, plain-spoken, whatever, or even a halfling, a, you know, fun, loving, friendly. Now, here's the thing. Okay, I'm a halfling. You know, I'm a chubby guy that likes to have a good time. But if I had to decide, I mean, and of course, in reality, I am a human. But if we're going with the metaphor, I'm a halfling, right? I'm a homebody. But if I had to be either a dwarf or an elf, I'm obviously an elf. You know, having to choose between gruff pragmatist and weird intellectual, I'm definitely a weird intellectual. So it says something about the health of my attitudes about myself that I despise elves quite so much. But it's easy to make these guys despicable. Just, you know, if you have to go to them for help and they're just like, oh, okay, did you see a lich? Where did you see the lich? And what this further means is that, like, this elven attitude of everything kind of being a game is how you get reckless magical experimentation, which is the other kind of major elf villain, right? Is that the mage who is out of control, tampered with powers beyond his comprehension, because as the pinnacle of the civilized races, he assumed that nothing was beyond his comprehension. And he's got a tower and it's full of summoned monsters and yada yada yada. So if we've defined kind of snobbery and arrogance as elven cultural traits, then the second villain flaw after a lack of sympathy is going to be, well, I mean, I've said arrogance, but it's not just arrogance, it's hubris. Elves think they have a special connection to the gods, and that wouldn't be hubris if it were true, but as DM, it is up to you to decide whether it is true or not, and I would argue that it probably isn't. So elves digging out dusty tomes, getting, you know, obsessive about recondite lore, and it definitely, you can sense the idea that elven culture tends to reward that sort of obsessive behavior, right? You've got hundreds and hundreds of years to spend mastering the sword, or learning the art of flower arranging, or delving into the deepest secrets of spellcasting. So naturally, that is sometimes going to lead you down dangerous byways. There's also a good brief for sympathetic elf NPCs, right? Like, it only takes a very few minor adjustments of the dial to turn an elf NPC who has that kind of reckless hubris into a lovable goof who keeps getting into scrapes, right? You can have some kind of explorer character who's always sailing off in his boat with this, like, wanderlust. He has to, you know, see whatever's beyond the next horizon, and then he's always finding stuff and gets into trouble, and you have to come and bail him out. But the villainous version is just the person who gets corrupted by power, and every other elf sorcerer, you know, then you go and tell the other elf wizard, and she's going to be like, ah, yes, the poor fool. He thought he could handle those forces, he just wasn't strong enough. Now I, by contrast. So you combine that sense of destiny and that exalted self-image with the immortal's callous disregard for the value of human life, and you've got someone who's just waiting for one good push to make them a villain. The third and final version is just the, like, elves are evil thing. See, here's the thing. In Dungeons & Dragons, we are frequently kind of replicating the tropes of romantic views of medieval literature, or of medieval literature, I mean, not completely different. That is to say, a system that believes that nobility and aristocracy are real and that they're good things, right? Elves are aristocrats, and they are what aristocrats would like to imagine that they are like. Right, they are a breed above others, dignified, graceful, noble, wise, brave, good-looking. They are not just a bunch of thugs and or spongers extracting value from the hardworking people beneath them. So it doesn't take very much to take elves as aristocrats and just rotate them through the lens of, you know, the actual injustice of what that is. And, you know, just take this group of people who think that they're better than others, even if they are better than others, the way that they treat those below them could be pretty bad. This goes back to something that we were saying over on the Patreon feed about, you know, what would elves be like in a Cthulhu mythos-dominated D&D setting? And the answer is, of course, Elric of Melniboné, a decadent aesthete who just doesn't care anything about the lives of the people around him or anything above his own kind of, like, I don't know, romantic self-actualization or overbearing ennui or something. It's been a long time since I read the Elric books. But you could actually, like, all you have to do is take the protagonist of a given manga and just imagine what a swine that guy would be in real life. Like, if you actually met him, what a pompous, self-centered, inconsiderate dirtbag this person would be. And then imagine a whole culture based on that. Give you some real Game of Thrones nonsense. The beautiful palaces of elven princes full of conniving, backbiting, double-dealing dirtbags. Each of them more fabulously elegant than the last, but all of them just bitter and malicious, caught up in the intricate details of their game, unwilling to do any real work. So, you know, either they do it with magic, which of course carries its own problems, or maybe they have slaves. You can see the break between kind of your wood elf and your high elf types would be between people who think that the sort of supreme expression of beauty is to be found in art and those who think that it's to be found in nature. But neither of them would think that it would be found in human civilization, that ugly compromise. That town, with its muddy streets and its thatch roofs and the algae on the surface of the well water and the pigs and the chickens, is an eyesore. That's not what elves would build. Elves would build a beautiful town with clean sweeping lines and flowers blooming everywhere. And okay, maybe some of those houses would be torture chambers, but they would look nice. And this is really good because you can imagine the tyrant that an elf monarch becomes very easily. To some degree, I'm just talking about the drow, right? Like, the drow are what you already get when you take elven culture and you just alter some of its starting preoccupations. You know, just take ideas like justice and dignity out of the elven repertoire and you get these murderous, degraded conspiracy freaks. And you actually don't even have to twist them all that far. You know, I've said before that one of the reasons that I don't really like the drow as a concept is that I feel like a race of evil elves removes the possibility for regular elves to be the villains in a scenario. And I feel like there's no reason, you know, if elves have moral agency, then they can be bad guys. And as bad guys, you know, what kind of bad guys would they be? Well, in some, there are certain types of bad guy that are probably beneath the dignity of an elf. You know, no elf was ever, like, went around mugging people. Now, I'm sure that some elves were, like, daring cat burglars or dandy highwaymen. No elf was ever a crooked ward healer. That's not extra enough for them. So your villainous elven politician has to be some kind of Machiavellian backstabber or iron-fisted tyrant. I guess basically you take that romantic ethos and you apply it to a game that is not generally romantic, right? These are romantic or gothic characters. Like, imagine what a complete pain in the neck a typical Byronic antihero would be in real life. Every time I think about that conversation when Byron brags to Dr. Polidori about how the reason that he's better than Polidori isn't his title, it's that he'd shoot the pips off an ace at so many paces and he can swim the Hellespont and whatever, I just keep imagining Polidori looking at him and going, "I am a doctor, dum-dum." Like, just imagine what kind of a creep a Byronic anti-hero would be in real life, and then that's an elven villain, right? Now, the trick of it is, this is the danger. We have spent 100-whatever years as a society mocking those characters. Probably no fictional archetype has been more thoroughly mocked relative to its level of basic resilience than the moody, hair-over-the-eye, loner anti-hero. So if you're going to have that kind of elven villain, the decadent aesthete or the, you know, brooding obsessive, you have to make them exaggerated in both their capability and their cruelty, because otherwise they become a laughingstock. And that's no good. You have to have this character who looks like she came out of a comic book, right? This ridiculous, whatever, goth assassin with big floopy lace cuffs and, you know, maybe some really elaborate eye makeup. And everybody goes, "What's up, Queen of the Undead?" Like, and they just make fun of her. And then she has to stab someone. She has to stab them up nice. You have to have that revelation, like, ooh, these people are serious. It's very easy to see how a society of detached, cerebral aesthetes who are basically immortal and who have enhanced magical powers could turn into a group that perceived themselves as a master race. Because regular scrubs in real life consider themselves to be a master race, right? Like, every person in the world who thinks that the race that they belong to is superior has no evidence of any kind on which to base that. And yet, there are millions, hundreds of millions of them. But elves actually have some kind of evidence to go on. I mean, it's dumb. Like, oh, they live longer. They don't need to sleep. They resist being charmed or whatever kind of nonsense, right? But they are visibly, definitionally different from humans and in ways that are superficially accessible, like dumb stuff like they're better looking. You know, when you're constantly surrounded with a society that tells you we are better than these crude humans with their brutish attempts at science and magic, you would just grow up with that feeling. You know, it would be a rare elf who broke that social conditioning. Most people aren't ahead of their time, and you can't really blame them. In my campaign, elves were like this, right? They were the dying remains of a once arrogant empire who had become even more detached and insular, basically out of an unwillingness to confront the meaning of their failure. Anyhow, those are the three levels of elven villainy: unsympathetic polity, arrogant dunderhead, and monstrous tyrant. Me personally, I'm a monstrous tyrant, man, but if you want to leave, you know, a basic campaign setting, you know, if you're playing in the Forgotten Realms or whatever, there's plenty of room for 1 and 2. In fact, I would argue that in sort of traditional D&D, 1 is meant to be the normal thing, right? That elven communities are supposed to be a little bit insular and xenophobic, not necessarily super, like, immediately thrilled about dealing with outsiders, and having elven party members is a great way to deal with that problem. So I feel like there's so much to talk about here that I've only barely scratched the surface, and yet we're running long as I record this. It'll probably be shorter when I release it. But Stan, I hope that touched some fun ideas for playing elves as monsters. Thank you once again for your continued support of Monster Man. In our next episode, we'll be going back to Monster Manual 2 to take a look at demons. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.